طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. This morning we feature our own Alice Rothschild speaking in New York City about her most recent book, Condition Critical. Alice, brought up in a religious Jewish family, was freed from the Zionist myth she was brought up with by her zest for truth, justice, inquiry, and her compassion for the human condition as an obstetrician-gynecologist. Alice is now spending full time documenting her frequent travels to Palestine, Israel, and elevating the Palestinian narrative through her books, films, and lectures. Here is Alice Rothschild speaking on Condition Critical.
So I was in the region in January, and I was having a dinner with a young doctor who had actually stayed at my home in Boston, because I was involved with a group that set up an exchange program between Harvard University and Al-Quds University. So she was staying at my house and doing rotations at Harvard. So I went to visit her, and we're, you know, sitting having dinner, playing with her brother, playing with her enormous white pet rabbit, and she mentions this little story. So she says that she missed her ride to the hospital in East Jerusalem. She lives in Ramallah, and so she had to take the bus. And she got on the bus, and the bus went to Kalandia checkpoint, which is the checkpoint between Ramallah and East Jerusalem. And being a Palestinian woman, I mean, she's all of 5 feet tall, kind of shy, demure. She had to get off the bus, and the soldiers took her aside and started going through her stuff. And her mother had made her lunch, and her lunch was a salad of tomatoes and cucumbers, chopped up very fine, an Arabic salad. And the soldier went ballistic and started screaming, "Where's your knife? Where's your knife? I see the chopped up salad. I know you have a knife," and pointed a gun at her head and was threatening to kill her. At which point she started screaming and crying and fainted. And she mentions this story like, you know, this is what happened today on the way to the hospital. And I think it's an example of what we can learn if we really pay attention to the intimate details of life under occupation. So what I'm going to ask you to do is basically to take a journey with me through readings from my book. And also, you will find out I'm a compulsive blogger person. So I'm going to weave some of my blogs from my January trip with essays from my book. And I hope to raise questions, expand your horizons, give you a sort of more personal, intimate look at the region. And it's obviously just a taste. It's not the history of the universe. I'm leaving a lot out. But I want you to be interested in what we're talking about. I also think that the sort of front line bearing witness and then sharing these personal narratives is actually a very powerful way to search for the truth and also to find a context in which history is being made. So first of all, I'm going to tell you a teeny-weeny bit about me, since most nice Jewish girls aren't doing this kind of work. And so this is from my book. I once heard a religious studies professor describe those Jews who engage in critical activism on Israel-Palestine as entering a special kind of exile. I had spent my early years in a very familiar American Jewish place, with immigrant Orthodox roots and a Hebrew school upbringing. But then I encountered the activism of the 1960s. I started to learn about Israel's increasingly belligerent occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and its multiple hard-to-defend wars. And I developed a growing awareness of what we now call cross-sectional issues around racism, police brutality, militarism, and U.S. foreign policy. I found I had to re-examine the meaning of my own Jewishness in light of the uncomfortable consequences of Zionism. And I started to grapple with my own personal responsibility as a Jew and a U.S. citizen. I discovered that within the U.S., there was a wide chasm between the dominant national mythos regarding the founding of the State of Israel and its struggle for survival, and the experience of Palestinians who lived the other side of that struggle. As I searched for an honest conceptual language, the chasms between the different framings of, quote, the conflict became glaringly obvious. Is this a clash of civilizations? Another example of several thousand-year history of Jewish persecution and determined survival, this time rising out of the ashes of the Holocaust? Is this a struggle for haven for Jews everywhere? Or is the current occupation, as opposed to liberation, begun in 1967, actually a continuation of more than 100 years of colonization of Palestine, of treating Jews as more deserving, more human than Palestinians, and of Palestinians periodically, like many indigenous peoples, fighting back? More importantly, does a national settler movement triggered by European anti-Semitism that is grounded in the privileging of Jews and the belittling, dehumanization, or hatred of Arabs inexorably lead to where we are today? My first step was to understand the realities on the ground. So as mentioned, I am an obstetrician-gynecologist, so you'll find some of my readings are focused on women because I'm particularly interested in women. And also I this is my third book, and I have a film that came out. So this book is this collection of blog essays written in real time on the ground. It's focused mostly from 2013 to 2015, but I draw back to my annual trip starting in 2004, and I led health and human rights delegations to the region. Now, obviously, my interest in this part of the world started very young. I made my first pilgrimage to Israel with my family when I was 14, but my views on the situation really changed in the 1990s when I began to learn about the occupation and its consequences. You will find that I have a very human rights focus. I think a lot about power and what it means to be in solidarity with Palestinians and progressive Israelis, and also what is the meaning of co-resistance. I want you to be thinking about the contradictions between the, quote, modern Jewish democracy, which has a thriving economy, you know, big high-tech industry, powerful army, the Israel that we see in the New York Times, and that this, at the same time, this Israel suffers from a siege mentality, despite its enormous power and dominance. I want you to think about the importance of facing the Nakba, the Palestinian experience of 1948, and making this invisible history visible. I want you to understand the ongoing ghettoization of Palestinians and the enormous irony that once ghettoized Jews are now inflicting this on another population and the kind of institutional racism and discrimination that this entails. And I want you to see Palestinian civil society activism as a positive force. Palestinians are not only victims. I also want you to understand the rise of the Jewish-Israeli right. Israel is an increasingly militarized, racist, and fearful country. There's an expanding Jewish settler movement that, for all purposes, it looks like is just going to explode with Mr. Trump in charge. The left is very marginalized and really stumbling over the big question of what to do with Zionism, with Jewish privilege. I think it's also important to think about the complacency of most Israelis. I mean, Israel's a very diverse population, but in general, Jewish Israelis are very content with the idea of a controlled conflict. So when you talk to Israelis in general, which is a big sweep, but Israelis are basically worried about the loss of the social safety net, the rising cost of living, rising house prices, the racist issues around Mizrahi Jews. The occupation is largely invisible. In other words, Israelis are a lot like us. And when I was there, Palestinians were saying to me about Mr. Trump, which we talked about endlessly, now you have your own Netanyahu. So I first want to look at the question of how does history disappear? And I'm going to take you to the village of Lifta, which was a beautiful old village that was right near Jerusalem. So we're on a tour with an Israeli organization called Zachrot, which is a Hebrew name meaning remembering, and we're at the beginning of the tour. The signage reads, En Neftoa, Lifta. And Umar, he's the guy from Zachrot, explains that Neftoa is a biblical place located somewhere near here, and that the Israelis added N to Hebraicize the name as well as to give an ancient reference. We scrambled down a steep, rocky path past a dusty construction site that is part of a new project to build a train track to Jaffa that will include bridges and tunnels through this area. He points out in the distance the Jewish National Fund forest near the Jewish settlement of Ramot, as well as destroyed villages such as Bidu. The Knesset and many governmental offices, the High Court, and even parts of Hebrew University are all on Lifta. Omar explains that before 1948, Lifta contained 10,000 dunams, with 40,000 more cultivated outside the village, and a population of 3,000, all of which constituted a big, wealthy town. There were many olive trees and vegetables planted from seed, and it was a lush and prosperous place. 50 of the 400 houses are left. Today, most Israelis do not make the connection between a park with graceful ruins and the Arabs that once inhabited them. As we scramble around the stone paths and move in and outside of crumbling homes, the sunset creating a shimmery, streaking light, the extraordinary beauty of Lifta is painfully obvious. There are the original fig trees and lush Saber cactus, wells and aqueducts, ancient terraces, and amazing architecture with graceful archways and floors dating from different centuries and now crumbling from age and neglect. At the base of the valley, we come across two pools, canals led from the pools to irrigate the various gardens below, and each family had plots for figs and almonds, apricots, and vegetables. So Umar explains that in 1947, the UN partition plan was announced. But before the State of Israel was declared and before the Arabs attacked, Jewish militias immediately started to occupy villages beyond the partition line. Lifta and Jerusalem were supposed to be international zones, but clashes with the Irgun and Stern Gang, two militant Zionist groups, started in 1947 and in early 1948. Irgun fighters dressed as tourists came into a Lifta coffee shop and shot six people, wounding seven. This created a wave of fear, and the families living on the edges of town fled to East Jerusalem and Ramallah. A month later, the Irgun bombed all the empty houses and then started attacking roughly every week. The inhabitants were terrified and fled to Ramallah, but 30 to 50 young men stayed with meager ammunition and guns. The Haganah and Irgun attacked over and over again, and then David Ben-Gurion famously declared that you can now enter Jerusalem through the Lifta area, quote, without seeing any strangers. In other words, it was Arab-free. Then on April 9, 1948, 120 men, women, and children were massacred in nearby Deir Yassin, and the Jewish soldiers took a group of captured women on a victory tour around the city and then dumped them at the Jaffa Gate. The Arab population panicked and fled to Ramallah. The Israeli forces declared all the fleeing homeowners absentees and confiscated all the property for the state. There is now a plan to finish the destruction of Lifta and build a posh new Jerusalem neighborhood. And although there is a campaign fighting this proposal, Omar predicts construction will start in a few months. When he says this, I am seized with a wave of grief and rage and start taking photos of every stairway, crumbling wall, olive press, desperately trying to document the world that may soon be erased. So I now want to explore the whole issue of coexistence. Everybody is in favor of coexistence. And the city of Haifa is famous as a city of coexistence. So this is from January of this year, and I'm on a tour of Haifa with an activist whose name is Jihad. And we're walking, so you're walking with me. Walking through Haifa, Jihad explains that before 1948, 70,000 Palestinians lived in the city. It was a major commercial center, and workers were attracted from other Arab countries. In 48, after the barrel bombs rolled down from the hills of Carmel and the forced expulsions drove inhabitants into the sea, where the lucky ones were able to reach Lebanon, raising the obvious question, who exactly drove whom into the sea? There were 1,200 Palestinians left. The Israelis declared their homes absentee property and herded the remnants of the population into a prison-like ghetto called Wadi al-Nasnas. Wadi al-Nasnas became the center of Palestinian cultural life. The population of 40,000 Palestinians is now like a city within a city, contradicting Haifa's claim to be a center of coexistence. Most Jewish Israelis live separately from their Palestinian neighbors through the forces of history, culture, economics, and unwritten policies, including the refusal of banks to give mortgages to Palestinians in certain neighborhoods. The schools are also segregated, although the Palestinian children are taught the usual Zionist curriculum, devoid of Palestinian history, the Nakba, Arabic poetry, even in their segregated schools per Israeli law. Jihad explains that when he bought a home, and he's a lawyer, in a nicer area, he was charged $15,000 more than a Jewish Israeli. And when he moved into the upscale property, he was told that he was not allowed to speak to any of the future owners until the property was entirely sold. His Arabic would bring down the property values and potentially ruin the neighborhood. So we keep walking, and the neighborhoods drift towards increased shabbiness, with abandoned and crumbling properties as we head towards the water. Jihad explains that when the Palestinian properties were seized, they were put under Israeli governmental companies that then collected rent from the former owners. Through social media, Jihad and his fellow activists are tracking down the original owners and exploring the possibilities of returning properties to these pre-1948 title holders. He patiently explains that it is against international law to sell or renovate the properties of people who have been expelled. Quote, "This is the challenge. Are we going to buy our brothers' houses or leave them to Jewish Israelis to buy? We want to highlight this. There was wealth here. The Jews wanted to buy here because of the Oriental flavor, which was very popular. We spot magnificent old houses surrounded by barbed wire or with windows and doors boarded up to prevent return. Walls are crumbling, grass and shrubs cling to cracks in the stone and window ledges. Stairways fragment and garbage tumbles everywhere. We are on the cusp of gentrification, and beyond us looms the gigantic port. Immense blue cranes, oil tankers, and cargo containers piled like blocks, a vast multi-story glass missile-shaped architectural monster, a governmental building, rises up out of the courthouse, which is shaped like a ship with huge glass wings coming in from the First World as if bringing justice to the savages in the Levant. In this neighborhood, with the long cascade of stairs and in an old crumbling building, Jihad and his friends held their first Israel Apartheid Week. They cleaned the place up, set up banners and educational materials, and reclaimed the invisible but really quite obvious history if you choose to see it. As we walk along, Jihad is constantly taking photographs, videos, postings on Facebook, reaching out to the refugees in the diaspora, the cities, the camps. He finds that an old man in Lebanon or a refugee in the Gulf recognizes a house, a doorway, a street, and responds, and thus the connections are being made, and the missing links in the chain of lost human history reassembled. It is thrilling, exhausting, time-consuming work. Ironically, the street was originally called Iraq Street, but is now Shivat Zion, returned to Zion, located, even more ironically, in Justice neighborhood. So I'm now going to turn to the West Bank, and I have like a million stories from the West Bank, but I want to start out looking at the issue of refugees. So in the West Bank, there are 19 refugee camps and about 750,000 refugees that are registered. And I'm going to just take you for a walk in Aida refugee camp. So Aida is located in Bethlehem. It's one of three camps in Bethlehem. And we've stayed overnight with this family, and now the father in the family is taking us on a tour of the camp. Our host father and his two young daughters begin leading the tour of the Aida refugee camp after a breakfast we prepared together with his wife. He smokes constantly, and like many Palestinian men, has done his stint in Israeli jails. After 2 years, he was released and given a permit that limited his movements to Bethlehem for life. His family has had many Israeli home invasions, and the Israeli Defense Force killed his brother and sister and bombed his mother's house. He has many skills in construction and is an expert electrician. He has no paid work currently, but dreams of building his wife her cooking center, which when it opens will raise money for their disabled son and help empower other women by teaching Palestinian cooking to local and international visitors. IDF soldiers visited our street last night, and this morning we can see the spirals of tear gas 100 meters away as young boys run down the street toward the camp's iconic entrance, a large house key over the gate. The massive gray concrete wall at the entrance to the camp is surrounded by garbage, and a gray IDF guard tower completes the triptych. In 2014, Pope Francis visited the camp and prayed at this wall, as if to say to all the world, "This exists. See, it exists." It appears that the tear gas is also in the vicinity of the boys' UNRWA school, and they are taking exams. Our host mentions that the IDF soldiers use the boys for target practice. The boys run toward the conflict, grabbing stones. The girls run home. His younger daughter is now handing out geraniums she has picked. The camp has no green space, but tons of children who need to play and release the rage, frustration, and fear that infuses the air and tear gas they breathe. We hear the history of dispossession in 48, the UNRWA tents, the UN houses. The inhabitants endured poverty, trauma, depression, and appalling overcrowding. Many men went to work in Israel to provide food for their families. My host explains that he is afraid for his children. He tells them to stay away from the soldiers. He deeply cares for them. The soldiers do not. Quote, "We want peace." His Jewish Israeli friends occasionally visit him, but of course he cannot leave. More tear gas, more boys dash by. There's a painting of a fierce orange tiger and the words, "Here only tigers can survive." On the adjacent wall are two orange butterflies and the words, "Here only butterflies and birds are free." Another young boy races past. We see a church in the camp and then cautiously look at the wall a few blocks from the guard tower. There's an enormous graffiti of a boy with a slingshot. I spot Arabic graffiti supporting Fatah, but surprisingly little related to any political party. There's a general sense of disgust for all parties. Roosters are crowing, and a haze of tear gas hangs over the homes. My host talks about wanting his children to get a good education and to go, quote, to the best universities. He, like many fathers, has great hopes. He points out the agricultural land stolen when the wall was built. Property his father would have given to him as part of the next generation of sons. I see teenage boys collecting small stones, begging us for dollars, cigarettes. My host pats them on the head and tries to dissuade them from throwing stones. They do not listen. So another important thing that goes on in the West Bank is popular resistance. And in January, I spent a day in Be'elin, which is a Palestinian village right up against the Green Line. And some of you may have been there on Friday when there are marches fighting against the separation wall that's being built. And so we drove out to Be'elin, and we got stopped by a flying checkpoint. And then we got there, we were met by Iyad Barnat, who's the head of the popular struggle, and the brother of the guy who made Five Broken Cameras, which is the film about this town. So he leads us through the village. It's a hundreds and hundreds year old village, very quaint and beautiful. And then beyond it are the newer homes. His home, which he's built over the years, is on his wife's property because the settlement has taken all of his family's property. So we're sitting, you know, in the porch of this beautiful home. We meet his wife, a 17-year-old son, a younger daughter, a dynamo of a three-year-old boy who wakens from a nap, snuggles with his baba, and then charges into constant motion. His oldest son, Majd, attends Birzeit University. In 2014, he was targeted and shot in the leg by Israeli snipers. His father bears the weight of knowledge that his son was not targeted by accident, and that now he is worried about his 17-year-old who, quote, plays with the soldiers, with the lack of vulnerability that is characteristic of teenage boys who have experienced more than their share of violence and trauma. Iyad explains that the flying checkpoints around the village have become a daily interference, that the Shabak takes the youth's IDs, and then they have to report to Ofer prison for interrogation. The scare tactics are designed to produce collaborators. "Do you know this guy? What was he doing? Demonstrations? Throwing stones?" The frightened boys either talk or lie and are then caught in the lie. In 2006, three children were arrested, and the next week, 30 children and adults were arrested. The villagers have educated the children on what to do, mostly to answer, "I don't know." "What's your name?" "I don't know. You have my ID. You know my name." Iyad's brother was jailed for 10 years. When he was released, he studied law. Now he works at Ofer prison defending the arrested. Iyad shows us a series of extraordinary photos. 2 weeks ago, the three-year-old led the weekly Friday demonstration, carrying a Palestinian flag. The commander told him, "Go back." He replied, "No, I want to see the jeep." The IDF soldier repeated his command, but the defiant three-year-old marched forward and sat down in front of the jeep. Then he picked up a gas bomb strewn on the ground and said, "I don't like this, it's yours," and handed the empty cartridge to the soldier. Iyad is clearly proud and terrified. He explains, "The Zionists say that you teach your children to hate. This is not the way with Palestinian children. We have lots of Jewish visitors and friends. We teach them to talk with the soldiers and not to be scared." So then we go off to see the land that was reclaimed after the wall was moved, because they did win back some of their land, and it's all being replanted. Gorgeous rows of spinach, cauliflower, and broccoli are growing happily with drip and sprinkler irrigation. The water in the village is bought from the Israeli company Mekarot and then pumped into the fields. As we approach the western lands, the massive settlement of Modin Elite, population 60,000, increasingly dominates the landscape. For me, the contrast between the mammoth building project and this rural Palestinian village is frighteningly horrific. Huge cranes hover over massive apartment buildings stacked aggressively up the hills in various states of construction. There's a yeshiva and huge bulldozers and earth-moving equipment, mountains of dirt. The settlers are primarily white Ashkenazi Jews, mostly from New York City, who feel they are fulfilling God's promise to reclaim Judea and Samaria. The tone is aggressive, dominating, architecture as military maneuver. Iyad explains that the green hill to the left will soon be covered by more settlement construction. Iyad talks of accomplishments and dreams, quote, "We are farmers. I love to grow food from the land." He wants to plant his food, feed his family, live in peace, and to support other farmers in reclaiming this land and making it fertile and functional again. He keeps squatting amongst the plants and snapping up a bit of fava beans or parsley or cilantro or peas or cauliflower. We munch happily, as he explains. The soil is rejuvenated after years of neglect and the detritus of toxic weaponry by adding new topsoil and manure. He's working on a proposal to reclaim a dunam of land for each farmer in need, build a greenhouse, fence each area against animals, and offer the farmers in the village the possibility of growing enough food to feed their families, summer and winter crops, having viable work, and the ability to sell their grapes or vegetables to pay for meat or water or electricity. Preparing each dunam costs $12,000. Maybe Trump could hold off on the next warplane and donate to the cause. One would certainly do it. And the next day was Friday, and on that day, his 17-year-old son was shot in the head by the soldiers. And he's not, you know, he's okay, but he was shot in the head. Which brings us to the violence against Palestinian children. And there's this horrifying statistic that since 2000, an average of 2 to 3 Palestinian children have been killed by the IDF each week. And so I want to get into more about prisons and mass incarceration. So I have met a number of times with a group called Adamir. It's a prisoner support group. And they estimate that 40% of the male population in Palestine has been arrested since 1967. You know, and the West Bank and Gaza are all under military rule. So the big question is, what do people get arrested for? So this is from a meeting with Adamir. So for what crimes are Palestinians languishing in jail? There are 2,000 military orders in the West Bank, but number 1,651 is the most common and includes participation in demonstrations, destruction of public order, raising the Palestinian flag in Jerusalem, and belonging to a legal party. The military frequently goes after political activists who are convicted of writing slogans on walls or throwing stones. That offense warrants 10 years imprisonment for a stone thrown at a non-moving object and 20 years for one thrown at a moving object. 90% of children who are arrested are accused of throwing stones. 60% are arrested between midnight and 5 a.m., ripped from their beds at night in front of terrified and powerless parents. And until recently, children 16 and older were tried as adults. Palestinian childhood appears to be an ephemeral and brief experience thanks to occupation. There are 700 child detainees per year, more than 8,000 since 2000. Rhonda, who's the woman from Adamir, describes a number of tragic cases of young children detained, strip searched, mentally and physically tortured, pushed to be government collaborators in order to protect their families. Families are also forced to pay huge court fees. These traumatic experiences in children have major long-term implications. Some children stop speaking, refuse to attend school or to leave home, and suffer from bedwetting or loss of interest in life. So I was particularly interested in this whole area of child incarceration. And in January, I was actually able to go to Ophir Prison. So I was working with a guy named Ivan, who's with the Defense of Children International Palestine. And I'm here in this blog driving to Ophir Prison with Ivan. And basically, he's the advocacy coordinator of this Defense of Children. So he's taking me to that very Ophir Prison, an Israeli military pretrial detention center just outside Ramallah. This is not a usual stop on the Holy Land tour, but I am particularly interested in military detention, and in particular, arrests and detention of Palestinian children, and those who are doing the holy work of trying to keep them safe. And so as he drives, he's talking, and I'm frantically taking notes in the car. So he says, in prison, there is minimal psychosocial support or rehabilitation. The prison provides teachers, Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, who are permitted to teach Arabic, Hebrew, and math. Topics like history and literature are considered too dangerous, i.e. potentially politically and actually useful, to offer. During the sentencing phase, the child may receive a custodial sentence, a fine, or a suspended sentence. The average fine is 1,560 shekels, approximately $390. And if the family is unable to pay, the child receives an additional 4 weeks of prison for every 1,000 shekels. You could call this a money-making racket. Palestinian families support the system that imprisons their sons and daughters. The suspended sentence is like a probation period for 2 to 5 years, during which time, if the child commits another crime, he faces significantly more imprisonment. The suspended sentence has had an unexpected impact. Many children are so afraid of arbitrary arrest, they refuse to leave their homes. As Ivan says, so the children imprison themselves. Now, they have found that torture and ill treatment of children in Israeli jails has decreased, but there are more children in prison overall. So in February 2016, there were 440 Palestinian children in Israeli military prisons, the highest number since they started collecting statistics in 2008. And in 2015, the Israelis reintroduced administrative detention for minors. That's a policy of detaining people without charge or trial for indefinite periods of time. Ivan also notes that children are sometimes held in solitary confinement during interrogation before charges are made. This is also legally recognized as a form of torture, isolating the accused in order to break them to make a confession. There were 161 cases of child solitary confinement in 2016. The longest a child held was 26 days. This is mostly used against 16 and 17-year-olds, which brings us to the question, who exactly is a minor? Around 2012, the Israeli military defined a minor as a child less than 18 years of age, although criminal responsibility begins at 12. If 16 and 17-year-olds are convicted, they are sentenced as adults. So there's no consistency. This is, after all, military justice. And younger children can be detained, harassed, and released, but traumatized nonetheless. The other incredible number is that 97% of the children do not see their lawyer or their parents before interrogation. So finally, we arrive at Ophir Prison. It's a large concrete wall topped with barbed wire and guard towers that encase the prison, where pretrial hearings are held. Behind the central structure is a maze of cage corridors, turnstiles, and security checkpoints. My first impression is of the crowd of families waiting to pass security, the fear and fatigue etched on their faces. Some have traveled for many hours to see their loved ones have their moment in court. We enter an open cage bordered by metal wiring where family members who've been told by their lawyers that this is the day of the hearing wait and smoke and pace and wait. They are not given a time for the hearing. Periodically, an upscale-looking lawyer comes through and is swarmed by anxious family members. Beyond the turnstile are 7 large caravans where the court cases are heard. So Ivan finds a lawyer who agrees to our sitting in on a hearing, and we enter one of the caravans and sit in the back. 4 young men sit behind a wooden banister, their legs shackled. Children are also shackled, and I am told appear wearing the bulky adult jackets as there are no clothes to fit their size. I try to imagine being a skinny 15-year-old in a giant overcoat with shackled legs, appearing before the crunch of guards and a judge and lawyers, meeting a lawyer for the first time, scared and lonely. The military judge, wearing a kippah, sits on a raised platform with a stenographer, both pretty much glued to their computers. The military prosecutor, a young woman with a long pigtail, sits opposite. They are not actual lawyers, but military people trained in military law. In the middle are a cluster of real lawyers and guards that go in and out. The translator is a soldier, often a Druze, who serves in the army. There is nothing that resembles a trial going on here. No evidence or witnesses are called. Some lawyers know their cases, others are meeting them for the first time. They spend a lot of time striking deals with the judge, negotiating with the prisoners. There are smiles, angry voices, frustration. It all appears pretty chaotic. In minutes, major life decisions are made by the powers that be, and the prisoners leave. And then we go out and I start interviewing families. I am mostly struck by how routine and banal this whole process feels. The Israeli military has succeeded in normalizing the arrests, detentions, and imprisonment of children and adults who are resisting an oppressive occupation that is strangling their lives and their futures. And the Palestinians arrested understand that a good day is when a deal can be struck, maybe prison for 5 years rather than 10, maybe a suspended sentence and huge fine that devastates the family, but lets the guy go home in 6 months rather than 6 years. No one asks if children throwing stones at a heavily armed military force is a crime deserving months to years of imprisonment. So I'm now going to take you to Gaza, and I should say about half of my book is about Gaza. So I was there in 2005, and then 2015, and then last month. And in 2015, working with the Gaza Community Mental Health Program and interviewing people and doing women's empowerment workshops, what everyone had to talk about was their experience in the war. So I just heard horrendous stories over and over again of loss and death and crumpled houses and bombing, and it was just incredibly devastating stories. And I want to give you just a little bit of a flavor for what that is like. So I'm going to take you to a women's center called Aisha, and that's in Gaza, and do a reading from that blog. The management administrator and the project coordinator welcome me to the Aisha Association for Women with Husbands Who Are Mentally Ill or Addicted. These are the living and breathing families who have literally fallen off the curve. 14 women wait for us at a U-shaped conference room with one girl and one boy snuggled close to their mothers. I estimate the age range is 30 to 50, although I could be monumentally off, as women not surprisingly age prematurely under occupation and repeated trauma. Everyone has a chance to tell her story, and in subsequent weeks there will be group and individual sessions, various kinds of counseling, legal advice, job training, and other forms of support. At some point, almost every woman begins to weep, clutching tissues, and toward the end, even our interpreter bursts into tears. The amount of accumulated suffering in this room is stunning. The women talk about husbands with mental illness and drug addiction, most are abusing tramadol, who steal and do not care for their families. And children with many diseases due to intermarriage with close cousins, the toxic load from war, malnutrition, and lack of care. Families suffer from multi-generational overcrowding when growing households vie for a shrinking amount of space without privacy or healthy boundaries. Jealousy and competition abound. This is exacerbated by addiction, war, death, post-traumatic stress disorder. Poverty is rampant. Children are hungry, families rely on social services, and the women are clearly depressed, and some are suicidal. They talk about wanting to educate their children in universities and the difficulties in financing those dreams. Some see their children turning violent, out of control, addicted, and mirroring their fathers. The mothers desperately want to save them from their fate. The most recent war has caused extraordinary financial hardships and losses of housing, electricity, and water. I sometimes sink into stereotypical thoughts about tyrannical Arab families dominating mothers-in-law and the repressive role of fundamentalist Islamic family relationships. And then I remind myself not to judge. What we do know is that the more crushing the economy and the political landscape, the more oppressed and constricted the lives of women will be. Drawing attention to this fact is the task for feminists and all people who understand the intersections among war, patriarchy, psychological illness, domestic violence, and the cultures that make all this possible. The dedicated women of Aisha are taking the first steps on a long and challenging journey, and they deserve our sisterly support. So when I came back this year, women were more talking about their lives and issues currently, and the war was just a couple of paragraphs behind it. So I'm going to take you to another women's clinic and an episode there. And this is the Hayat Multipurpose Center. My interpreter and I joined a sociologist named Linda and a psychologist and an administrative assistant for introductions and the usual Arabic coffee. Linda explains that the center does research about women and gender violence and works to mediate problems between husbands and wives before they reach the court system. Funded by the UN, they have a psychological and social unit to empower family relationships. They offer free legal support, mediate when children are divided between parents who are separated or divorced, and they are thinking of developing a shelter for abused women. So we discuss a number of the projects there, and then we get into the forbidden topic of sexual harassment of children. Mothers come to the center saying their daughters have been raped by a cousin, an uncle, a father, and they are desperately in need of healthy interventions, particularly in a traditional society where loss of virginity, family shaming, and honor killings are still a problem. Rarely the mother asks for an attorney. Usually the request is for psychological intervention. They discussed a violent rape case 2 weeks ago that went viral on social media. An 8-year-old girl from Shejaria, which was a town that was completely decimated in 2014, was raped and severely injured by an 18-year-old neighbor. The boy was arrested, and the family has alleged that if the courts do not punish him, they may take justice in their own hands. This is what happens when there is no functional civil society and no adequate working legal system. I take a very deep breath and head upstairs to a living room-like setting where I'm meeting 6 more women who've come for a health discussion. And again, they're from 30s to 40s, and everyone looks older than I expect. I'm also impressed by how fashionable women can be with just a scarf and makeup to play with. So we talk about irregular bleeding and vaginitis and all the usual things that women talk about. And then we get to this. The most painful conversation occurs around a woman who wants to know about the hymen, and then says her daughter had an accident, which on further discussion was really a rape by a 15-year-old neighbor. The mother wants to know if the hymen can be reconstructed and will she be a virgin again. Even my unmarried translator is blushing. But many of the women have opinions for this lady and they are all contradictory. Clearly, the mother feels her daughter is damaged and potentially unmarriageable, although she's struggling to be supportive to her child and to avoid condemning her. Additionally, the father is dead, and no one else in the family knows. In fact, it would be a disaster if anyone found out. So this is also a big, painful secret. I can see the shame in her eyes, the fears about her daughter's future, her fears about families taking revenge. We talk about the meaning of virginity, blaming the victim, psychological healing, the long-term damage created by family secrets and shame, the re-traumatization that could occur if some gynecologist tried to fix her. I urge her and her daughters to begin psychological counseling, to begin the healing process. At the end, she looks sadly at me and says, "How can we change the society?" One woman stays after everyone leaves and in broken English looks at me and declares with desperation, "I need a job. Can you help me? Talk to your universities?" She is smart and has had some education in the field of multimedia and wants to complete her university studies. She's divorced and her husband has their 2 daughters. She wants to be a good mother. She wants to be able to provide them with what they need. She doesn't want to be dependent living with her mother and her sister. She wants a good life for herself. The words just pour out of her. So I listen and we talk. And once again, I am filled with an overwhelming feeling of inadequacy and outraged by the levels of struggle and injustice that these brave women face in this most difficult of places. So I think it's also important to remember that Gazans are not only victims. They are folks with a very strong culture of resistance and perseverance. And it's actually very inspirational to be in Gaza. The psychiatrist that I was working with did say that people are very much pushed to the edge of their ability to cope, but people are still coping. So I want to talk a little bit about cultural resistance and introduce you to an artist named Mohammed Musallam. So when we go visit him, his house is in northern Gaza, and the way the Israelis came in, they decimated all the villages and towns that were on the borders. And his house is standing, but the houses on each side are flattened, and the houses across the street are flattened. So it's like one little house that's left. We enter Muhammad's high-walled gate into a Garden of Eden, filled with irony and political satire. A meat grinder is part of a planter with a row of cacti and succulents. A mishmash of found objects, mostly dolls and children's toys, creates a collage that is at once a tribute to childhood and to its destruction. The air is filled with the perfume of jasmine. Grapes and figs are growing magically in the midst of desolation, and a collection of lively chickens cluck in a large coop. Muhammad is both passionate and impish, outraged at the world around him, filled with a passion for social and political commentary. He has made a candle holder out of a tear gas canister, a chandelier whose bulbs are replaced by candles. In 2008, the Israelis cut all the electrical cables in his neighborhood, and since then, things have been pretty dicey. The local electrical station was bombed in 2014. On average, he has electricity 3 to 6 hours per day and has gone for up to 30 days. He could use a generator, but fuel is too expensive. He took a photograph of a toilet. The toilet paper is made of a roll of Palestinian passports. Muhammad's mother lives on the second floor. His family lives on the third, and he has a studio on the ground floor where we sit. His wife has an Algerian passport, but chooses to stay. She adds, quote, "It has become normal. I find beauty, happiness, family. There is no choice. This is not courage." As we explore the wild jumble of found objects and striking paintings, Muhammad says, "We are normal. We are people. We are a small country. We have to live together. There is no choice." He has a gallows sense of humor, and he says, "We have 6 hours of gas, 6 hours of electricity, 60% of our salaries, 6 days every 2 months the border is open. Six must be our lucky number." He worries about how, quote, "Israel feeds hate, creating militants. I am an artist. I don't want to fight." He finds in his art both the intense paradoxes and the beauty around him. And another very powerful example of cultural resistance that I want to share is a day with a group, a parkour group. Do people know what parkour is? Okay, you'll find out. So I'd spent the morning at another women's center. All of these women had been living in Shejariya, so they'd all had these horrific war stories, and I was pretty depleted at that point. So I came back to our guest house and then joined some of the delegates for a drive to a town called Beit Hanun, the northernmost city tucked into the eastern shoulder of Gaza, just adjacent to the border. We drive through death-defying traffic, a constant game of playing chicken with folks who already feel they have nothing left to lose. There is pavement and rocky dirt roads, multiple rotaries, mountains of rubbish, and donkeys trotting, carrying massive piles of grasses and flowers and produce. We pass a route thousands of years old that once ran from Morocco to Turkey. Industrial areas, a huge building storing bags of cement, sheep trundling across the road, a bombed-out juice factory, and massive bomb craters, and piles of harvested rebar that is painstakingly straightened and reused. Everywhere, Palestinians are living their lives, going to school, buying and selling in the markets, walking in the streets, sweeping the dust. Mundane life goes on despite the post-apocalyptic surroundings. We continue to drive, passing one of the UNRWA schools being used as a shelter. Clothes and rugs hanging from the balconies, the smell of unwashed bodies in the air. 29 of the 89 UNRWA schools are still being used as emergency housing. We pull up to a massive scramble of crushed concrete jutting out at all angles, house after house crushed into deformed skeletons of a former life, hills of dirt and sand and toxic military waste and garbage. We park in front of that famous cat mural. A British graffiti artist, Banksy, painted an enormous kitten on a slab of vertical concrete. He knew that people would repost a photo of a cute kitten a million more times than they would a photo of a hungry, displaced Gazan child. We are soon surrounded by those very children, barefoot, dirty, ragged, beautiful open faces, blank stares, terrible teeth, sullen teenage boys flirting with us uncovered Western women. An Arabian horse gallops across the horizon, donkeys graze in open fields, and a water tanker with a familiar jingle makes the rounds. There's no running water here. We are actually here to see an amazing group of 11 young men doing a form of gravity-defying acrobatics called parkour. They mostly wear black sweatshirts with the logo PK Gaza, Gaza Parkour and Free Running. They dream of starting a school to teach their skills, of buying a video camera to record their feats, of entering parkour contests all over Europe. For them, jumping off of buildings, flipping backwards, forwards, twisting their supple bodies in various gravity-defying acts, is actually a positive channeling of their enormous energy and macho aggression. When too much of a crowd interferes with the show, not much entertainment actually happens here, they insist we drive together to Shajariya, the devastated city that was described to me by the six women this morning. I will not attempt to put into words the experience of walking into a nightmare. The massive amounts of concrete rubble, floors collapsed onto each other, bomb craters many stories deep in every direction. Young children clamber over this military jungle gym, living on the edge of serious injury and death. The parkour group seems unfazed, and soon I'm holding on to the powerful hands of various young men, hoisting my aching back and tired knees onto a ragged pile of rubble so that we can all have an excellent view of incredibly brave, athletic Gazans leaping across shattered roofs, tumbling and twisting through the air to precarious landings covered with rock fragments and jutting rebar. Their skill and energy is captivating. Their hands are soon oozing blood. They explain that when they jump, they feel like birds, forgetting the war, exercising their powerful male power, connecting with parkour groups all over the world. So I'm just going to end with this last reading, and what I want you to be thinking is, how do we know what we know? And I think it's important to be very aware of sort of the Israeli propaganda machine, and the word for Israeli propaganda is hasbara. Israeli hasbara is dishonest, because no amount of incredible dance, theater, music, computer technology, gorgeous desert hikes, or spiritual moments can erase the facts of occupation, siege, and discrimination. And I would argue it's not only deceitful, but also dangerous. In the United States, academics and students are under attack, and elected officials are cowed by AIPAC and the real fear of election loss should they cross the Israel lobby. Well-funded groups like Stand With Us, Campus Watch, CAMRA, the David Project, Israel Action Network, Amcha Initiative, the Institute for Jewish and Community Research, and a whole long list of others, and Christian Zionist groups work through selective and literal interpretations of the Bible, intimidation, one-sided history, and racist fear-mongering. Amcha has warned that Muslim and pro-Palestinian student organizations and professors who support boycott, divestment, and sanction, or who are critical of Israeli policy, are sources of anti-Semitism. And along with the Anti-Defamation League, has compiled lists of professors deemed dangerous to Israel. Even the U.S. State Department has a special category, anti-Semitism relative to Israel, that takes language directly from AIPAC and other Israeli Hasbara organizations. Ultimately, this cannot be good for the state of Israel, which grows more nationalistic, intolerant, and politically right-wing. Israel is increasingly at odds with a fragmenting diaspora community and less able or willing to negotiate with the Arab world with which it has to live. Ultimately, a state earns legitimacy by how it behaves, by how it treats its citizenry, by the decency of its foreign policy. For those who argue that this is an unbalanced analysis, that there are equally valid dual narratives, that people like me do not appreciate Jewish suffering and security needs, it is critical not to confuse nationalistic, discriminatory rhetoric with the actual historical, political, and on-the-ground realities. That reality must encompass a century of colonial settlement and Jewish entitlement that was born not only in the ghettos of Eastern Europe, but also from a racist nationalism that only endangers us further. In June 2016, Politico documented some highly critical comments from top Israeli security chiefs and military leaders. They warned of impending apartheid and fascism, of the dangers of Netanyahu to the state. They named the conflict with the Palestinians as Israel's central priority, not the presumed existential threat from Iran. The most damning moment came when the interviewer asked Yuval Diskin, who's the former head of the Shin Bet, so we're not talking about a liberal-minded guy, about a quote from Professor Leibowitz, a famous Israeli intellectual, quote, who warned back in 1968 that if Israel kept the occupied territories, it will be inflicted with the corruption typical to colonial regimes. The government will constantly have to deal with oppressing an Arab rebellion and with acquiring Arab kislings. The IDF will suffer from atrophy and become an occupation army. The interviewer then asked Diskin, "What do you think about the statement when you look at the state of Israel today?" Diskin looked straight in the camera and said, "I agree with every word of it." We should all worry when even the architects of occupation and military control think that the Israeli state has gone too far.
You have been listening to physician, author, filmmaker, and activist Alice Rothschild speaking on her book, Condition Critical. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.